Okay, so we're going to start for the second part. Just before we start, I'm going to play a little video. Now that I've explained something about task-oriented dialogue and how different task-oriented dialogues are compared to human-to-human form, this is a little skit that was on US TV that shows what it would be like if a human spoke like a machine. Okay?
Nice to finally meet you. I haven't been on a blind date in a while. So, Doug told me you work in customer service.
That's right. I do the voice recordings for companies such as United Airlines, Blue Cross, and Amtrak.
Wow, Amtrak, huh? Well, then I guess I have talked to you before.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Oh. No, nothing, stupid joke.
Hey, can I get you something to drink?
Oh, what do you think, Julia? Latte or cappuccino or something?
Did you say latte or cappuccino?
I said both. You know, do you want a latte or cappuccino?
My mistake. Cappuccino would be great. Gary, before we go any further, let me get some information.
Sure.
Please say your age.
Oh, yeah. I get that a lot. I know I look young, but I'm actually 29.
I think you said 19. Did I get that right?
No, 29.
I think you said 9. Did I get that right?
No. Wow, 29.
Okay, got it. Sorry, it's pretty loud in here.
Here you guys go.
Yum.
You know, Doug didn't tell me you're so cute.
Oh, you're not so bad yourself, Gary.
Hey, would you like to maybe see a movie tonight?
I'd like that. Let me check the movie listings. What movie would you like to see?
Have you seen Flight Plan?
Let me look that up for you. One second, please. Here it is. Flight Plan is playing at 7:15, 8:45, 10 o'clock, and 11:15.
Let's do 7:15.
Okay. This is a great date.
Really?
So what you have is her being this, you know, over-explicit, saying, I don't understand, which people don't actually say, and it makes her sound more like a machine than actually a real human. But thank goodness we don't actually do that, and we hope that systems are going to be better than that. So let us move on to the second set of slides. And the first thing I'd really like to talk about here before we go into the fully the ideas of a data-driven system is to talk about spoken dialogue personal assistants, okay? This was primarily talking about Siri, but now everybody does it. And in fact, I'd have to really thank Steve Jobs for putting speech systems at the forefront because I'm quite impressed that he thought they would actually work as well as what they did. But they did successfully push it forward, and now everybody does it, which is cool, okay? Speech is now the way that we sort of expect interactions to happen with machines, to the extent that even if you don't use it, you would consider it weird if somebody was trying to sell you a phone or a tablet that didn't have a speech interface. You now sort of expect it to be there, okay? Well, 10 years ago, it was utterly bizarre to even think about that. So, a number of people tried to do personal digital assistants for a long time before, even with speech, but they never quite took off in the same way, and it really needed a big company to go, we are going to do it, to actually get it out there. And there was a number of tricks that Apple did that made us, that tricked us into thinking that this was a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and we've all benefited from this in a big way. So speech in and out for individual use, okay? Is something that we'd like to be able to do, and now we do it, and now we expect it. And we're going to go into some detail about how these systems actually work and what they don't do as well. The sort of thing is controlling your schedule, you know, so that you can make meetings and you can get alerts. You know, for some time we've had devices, you know, personal digital assistant was the name of the phone before it had a phone in it, and we'd carry that around, and it would do things like scheduling. We'd like to control messaging, so I'd like to be able to send my message, I can speak, and I'd like them to be spoken to me, especially if they're important. You'd like to replace a human personal assistant, none of us are really senior enough to have a real personal assistant who goes around with you all the time and ensures that everything actually happens just before you get there. What I'm talking about here is not particularly about Siri, Cortana, Google Home, or Amazon Echo. It's just that all my students now work in all of these groups, and I sort of do know what they work on, but I'm not giving away any secrets in any way about this. You'll have to go and ask people here at Microsoft how Cortana actually works, though some of the Cortana people are at Google now. So what's it going to do? Okay, what would you like it to do? Okay, people says, I'd like to be able to talk to my phone and have it talk to me. What would it actually do? Okay, it's a good idea. People have seen Star Trek. They've seen these fancy robot things that you can just talk to. But what would it do? Okay, and this is an important thing. This is down to this task-oriented thing. It's all very well saying, I want a speech interface to my computer. So what are you going to talk about? Okay, so probably schedule-ish. But, you know, I have an unbelievably weird, busy schedule all the time at CMU. I have meetings probably every half hour during the whole day. And so my schedule is complex. Most people don't have as complex schedule as that. But even still, I'm not using a schedule all the time. I only use a few times a day to put in the new meetings and look up things. And some of that can be done by email, so it doesn't actually have to be spoken. So there's not many times that I could benefit from speaking to a system that could control my schedule. Phone calls in and out, okay? Most of you are not old enough to remember that there were things called phone calls, so maybe that's less important than what it used to be. Navigation, okay? Directions, well, we now sort of have that. That's fairly standard. It's going to tell us how to get about the place. We recently did some work with Suniana here about trying to improve Google navigation in Indian cities, particularly in Bangalore, so that the local names don't get mangled by the English synthesizer and have something that's a little bit closer to the Canada pronunciation. Finding local businesses with reviews, yeah, that's pretty useful. I don't know Bangalore. I've been using my phone to be able to find out where to go, what restaurants are like, where the coffee shops are, and I read the reviews, and it's pretty useful to be able to have that information when I'm looking things up. So I like that. That would be a useful thing. Open questions, okay? You know, we all want to know what the capital of France is. Sorry, for those of you who work in question answering, if you build a question answering system and it doesn't quite work yet, the single answer you should give is Paris, because the test sentence everybody does in question answering is, what's the capital of France? So you should just build into your system the first thing it ever says is Paris, and you're probably going to be correct. Okay, but open questions is quite important. Google's pretty good at it. But you'd like to be able to do any form of question answering when you're actually doing it. And reminders and alarms, okay? So you'd like to be able to say, your system, set an alarm in 10 minutes and tell me when that time's up, or set an alarm for tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. to remember me that I'm already late for the meeting that I'm supposed to be at. So these are the sorts of things that we'd like to be able to build in such a system. A little bit more about scope. So one of the early things that speech did on phones was basically allow you to call particular people. So you could say to the machine, call John. It would know who John was, even though John's an incredibly common name. But, you know, in your contacts, you would identify which one was John. And in fact, actually, what you would do is you had to say the name of each person on your contact that you wanted to be able to call directly, and it would record and keep that and be able to find what's most similar to what you're doing. So phones have been doing that for 15 years, I would say. Okay. The next one is, call John, Bill, and Mary and set up a meeting sometime next week about Project X that fits my schedule. Okay. I'd like to say to my phone to do that. None of them can quite do that yet. They can almost do that, but not quite. And basically, they can't really go and negotiate with either other people or other people's personal assistants in order to be able to do that. But that would be really useful. If I look at my email, a substantial part of it is a whole bunch of busy people trying to find a time that they can all meet. Yeah, we can use Doodle to be able to do that, and it works sort of well. In fact, it's almost always the case that people suggest things, somebody says yes, somebody says no, somebody says another one, and then about, I don't know, six mails into the exchange, somebody says, here's a Doodle poll, and then we maybe find somewhere at some time to meet. So that would be very useful for me if we could actually do something like that. Make a reservation at a local Chinese restaurant for 4 at 8 p.m. Okay? That's something that most of the assistants can sort of do now. They have to maybe pre-select which restaurants are available for that. But that's something that, you know, you would expect an assistant to be able to do. Okay. Reminders: you should call your mum as it's her birthday. Okay, that's a good thing to have. Okay, because you should call your mum as her birthday. But of course, the really useful one is this one. Okay, where your assistant says to you, "I've already sent flowers to your mum because it's her birthday." Okay, sorry, mum, not mom. I'm being American again. But you know, this last one is: do you want your assistant to be able to do that? A good human assistant would do that. Okay, but I'm not sure where the threshold is of acceptability or not. I mean, we saw how far these assistants can go to start becoming creepy in Monojit's presentation yesterday when he showed that Japanese assistant that was definitely on the side of, no, I don't want that. Okay, but somewhere in between there is something that we'd like to be able to build a system that could actually do that. Siri actually came out of US Department of Defense DARPA program in the 2000s. The program was called Kalo, a cognitive assistant that learns online. Its purpose was to try to build dialogue type systems and aids assistants that could learn through their usage. So instead of just having to code in new things to it, you could actually teach it through speech. Okay, this was a huge program. Okay, CMU was partly involved in it, generating some of the speech technology that was in it. And I was on this project, but not very importantly. And I went to some meeting and there was like 350 researchers in North America who were all involved in it. 350 is quite a lot, okay? So almost anybody who's working in speech and language in US government and universities and a little bit beyond, because they usually fund people beyond the US, were actually working on this. There was lots of different things that people were doing, but there was a small subpart of it that was really trying to build a personal assistant that was speech-based. This was based at the Stanford Research Institute, SRI, which is just off the Stanford campus in Palo Alto. They eventually built their system and decided they were going to have a spin-off company, and that's the reason it was called Siri, because it's SRI with an extra I in it. Because everybody knows that SRI itself can't be pronounced. Well, no, you guys know that SRI can be pronounced, okay? And so does most people in technology. But so they actually put the I into it. This company survived for some time. It was available as an app on both the iPhone and under Android. And they were bought by Apple in April 2010. they were really, you know, trying to do question answering and personal assistant things. Steve Jobs saw it and decided that this was a good way of the future for phones, which is interesting because that was quite a bold step. Now it seems obvious, and at the time it was definitely thought to be, when we heard that Apple had bought them, we did wonder whether they were actually going to put this forward as the main interface into their system. But people were doing this before, okay? This isn't something that just happened in 2012 when it first came out. Siri first came out. It actually was happening a long time before that. The platform issue was a big problem. It was always going to be computationally expensive to be able to do any form of recognition, interpretation, doing something in generation again. And so running speech recognition on the phone itself was something that's pretty frightening. We were also in a DARPA project at the time when we did speech-to-speech translation on handheld devices, which was just deeply frightening in the early 2000s because they were like 200 megahertz and memory that was almost as bad as printing out on a piece of paper and trying to read it back in again. It was just incredibly slow. So people were originally trying it with the desktop, but of course the desktop's useless because you can't really carry the desktop around. And realistically, if you're sitting in front of a computer, it's quicker to type. You can see the results. You don't really need to talk to it. It's the mobility that makes speaking actually a reasonable thing. And that's important to remember. Back in the mid-90s, most people have forgotten about this. There was a company called General Magic in the mid-90s. It was actually mostly funded by General Motors, hence the GM form. it was a normal phone, not a mobile phone, because mobile phones were pretty rare in the 90s. They weren't, they did appear, but and they had almost no computational power on them themselves. So what you would do is you would call up a number and then you'd get to speak to your assistant. General Magic started to do interesting, eventually it led to OnStar on General Motor cars, which is a now a speech-oriented system that sits inside the car that allows you to get information. It comes only with General Motors cars, although they do license it to other places and they use other technology in it. What's interesting about General Magic is that if you look at the senior members of General Magic who worked there in 1995, they now work and are senior people in Google, Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon. Okay, so the people who've been trying to do this have actually been trying to do this for 20, 30 years. Okay, well, some of them are retired, but I always find it pretty interesting because I knew some of the early people who were working in them, and then I know where they work. And they're working on the same problem, but now they've actually got some worth it. Once we started getting smartphones, okay, which actually happened before the iPhone, there was some small company called Microsoft, you might have heard of them, actually had smartphones way back in about 2001. My first smartphone was a Microsoft phone. Wasn't wonderful, but it was, hey, you could go online and you could use the phone. It was pretty cool. That you can have some local control. You can also display things. That makes a big difference because you can actually get information back. But also the cloud's there because it's got a network connection that allows you to be able to get that information out there. Doing things in the cloud sort of makes it possible. Speech recognition has always been hard. You need a big resources to be able to do it. The models are large. You need lots of computation. And it's sort of hard to do it in a little ARM processor. So people wanted to do it in the cloud. And so you had to have as good a connection to be able to pass things up. But most of the systems are still doing significant amounts of thing on the phone itself. There's one thing about the smartphone that makes it a little easier, and that is you know an awful lot about the person who's talking to the system. For the most part, smartphones are used by one person. Okay? Yeah, there are examples that that doesn't happen, but some extremely large 90x percent of the time, only one person ever uses it. And that's the person who's the owner of the phone. The contacts, the information that's coming in, out, in and out of that phone are the ones that you want to deal with. That means that you don't have to deal with everything. When you have a phone, you know where it is, so you know which city it's in, you know which cities it's been to, you know what language the person speaks, you know who their friends are, you know who they communicate with most often. You also know what they look up on search. You also know what music they like. And so there's a whole bunch of information that's actually already there on the phone. And that makes it much easier. Without that, if it was just a general kiosk that you went up to, it would know nothing about you, and it'd be much harder to be able to do any sort of interaction. And importantly, it's the same speaker almost all the time. So you can actually even do adaptation to the particular speaker. And you can do adaptation to both the language model space and in the acoustic space because it's most likely the same speaker. Sometimes it won't be, but most of the time it actually will be. The cloud, putting things on the cloud itself is a good thing because suddenly you get all the examples. So what Google did sort of publicly, but nobody quite worked it out, is very early on they said in the US they advertised this number that you could call and you could ask any question. Okay, and people were thinking, why would you ever want to ask a question to Google across the telephone, because you can't ever get the answer back in a reasonable way. To begin with, they were using humans to actually do the lookup directly and then give the answer back, but gradually their speech recognition got better. You think, this is still a useful thing, but actually what they were doing from about 2001, 2002, they were collecting data, okay? And what they were doing was they were finding out how people talk on the phone when they actually ask questions, okay? So it's a good trick, okay? And they also got feedback of whether they were giving the correct answer or not. So they had a way to be able to improve their system over time. So when everybody else was going, how are we going to use these smartphones to do things, Google started collecting data. Imagine that, a big company like Google worrying about where the data comes from. Oh, right, no, no, that's what they're good at. So they actually did that. So the cloud makes it sort of more possible because you're collecting all of the examples. And you can now put all that information together and have much more data for training. Yes, DNNs have helped speech recognition, but the more data has helped it more. Okay, that's a more important thing. Being able to find 100 hours of data 15 years ago was considered to be really hard work to do. Nowadays, finding tens of thousands of hours of data is pretty easy if you work for one of these big companies. So they're retraining acoustic models, language and understanding models regularly, okay? Because they're updating depending on what the news are and they have new things. And as technology drifts and we change how we interact with phones, we also have to move our training data, and they're collecting data. And that's an important part of how smartphones and personal digital assistants are actually improving. Voice search, as it used to be called, is another technology that people were using, again, in the 2000s. Before people were really doing digital assistants, you'd speak to your phone, it would show you the results, and you'd click on it. And what's very important there is what you realize is they got everybody to start labeling data. Okay, now maybe you didn't realize that was going on, but when you got your phone, you said Justin Bieber to it, and it showed you a bunch of options, you clicked on the one you want, what you're doing is you're labeling the data for them. Now they know which one was the right answer or which one was the best answer, and they're using that information to improve their system. Okay, so if there's a mispronunciation and people who do it regular enough, it's actually going to be what it's really going to be. Okay. And this is an important technology that people are trying to use all the time because it's a way to be able to make things better by deploying a system and getting feedback from your user, even if they're not explicitly aware of what's going on. The other thing that is still there as a big question is, how do people talk to devices? Okay, so when back in the days when search engines first came out, before there even was a Google, back in the days of Alta Vista and Lycos, the question was, how do people type in queries? And people thought at the time that people would type into something like, please show me all the web pages with Justin Bieber. Actually, probably Justin Bieber wasn't there in the 90s, but okay. All the web pages with some famous person from the 1990s. Full questions, okay? But of course, people stopped doing that fairly quickly, and they ended up just typing in Harrison Ford. Okay, so they just type in the name, so they did keyword search rather than full sentences. Now when it comes to speech, what are people going to do? Are they actually going to speak as full sentences, or are they actually going to speak with keywords? Now so far, it seems we're more inclined to speak full sentences in speech than we are to just saying keywords, which is sort of interesting. Okay, now that might be because the system responds with more complete sentences. But it's also quite good from the speech recognition point of view because it's easier to recognize long sentences than is isolated words because there's no context in isolated words. But at the moment, people are definitely saying longer sentences when they're talking to machines. But that might change.
That surprises me, full sentences. I would expect it would be somewhere between because I can type in, you're
It is somewhere in between. People say, you know, I would greatly appreciate the possibility if you might be able to show me some images of Justin Bieber. They're probably not going to do that, but they're not going to say Justin Bieber images.
Yes. And I was wondering just from the NLP, like, yeah. How does that make a difference that it's not full sentences? Does it make it easier or harder?
So it makes it easier. Because it's usually that the words that people say are the most relevant ones, and they're less likely to say the irrelevant ones. So when they say a word, it's probably relevant, but they're giving a little bit of structure to the sentence that they're actually doing. So they've got qualifiers, they may even have relative clauses in there that allow you to be able to constrain things. So it's, in some sense, easier. But I remember in voice search, in the 2000s, people were really worried about what way humans would go because most humans were not using speech. Well, humans are beginning to use speech to talk to machines and how they're actually going to do it. And partly it's how the machines are going to respond. Okay. But yeah, that's a good point. It's not completely open. The other thing is, because realistically they only care about English speakers, because that's where all the money is, which is not true if you look at the Chinese and Europeans. But there is this whole issue about, so how do people pronounce things? People are incredibly bad at pronouncing things. And therefore, when you're looking for the name of that Indian restaurant and you have some random American who just doesn't know how to say the name of the Indian restaurant, okay, they're going to mangle it when they say it. So what should you do? And so I remember meeting a group of people at Microsoft Research in Redmond, and their job was to come up with the wrong pronunciation for words that people might use when they're asking for things, okay? Because that's what people say. And as we know in language, now they don't always teach you that, language is what people say, it's not what they're supposed to say. And so you actually have to deal with, you know, that variance, that error, if you like, when people are actually saying, and then ultimately that becomes the word, okay? So maybe you have to care about it. So you do have to care about what do people actually say, and you actually have to deal with that. And so that became a thing, is like, there's no correct pronunciation for things. It's like, well, what do people actually say when they're talking about it? If you said you're going to do speech recognition for everything on the planet, the speech recognition people are going to say, oh my God, we can't do that. There's just too many words. There's just too many words. There's just too many weird words out there that are perfectly relevant in particular contexts and irrelevant everywhere else. But actually on the smartphone, life is not as complex as that, because it's not as general about that. The system behind it knows where the phone is. Yes, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the GPS doesn't work. Sometimes it's on Wi-Fi and it's got VPN of hidden where it actually is and you don't know where it is. But for the most part, you know what city the phone is in. Therefore, you constrain the language model in the big way. In fact, you do that a lot more because you know who the person is using the phone, you know what they've done before, you know what their who their contacts are. You can probably quickly know their age, or at least their age range. And it's much more constrained. And it's not the case that you have to deal with a 10 million word vocabulary. You can actually be much more constrained. And therefore, they do this. They've got some general vocabulary for everything, but they know what you're likely to say, and therefore they're going to offer it. They're going to know who you're talking about. And one of the interesting things on the iPhone was that, which I don't know if Android has, is you could give the pronunciation of people's names. Okay, so you could actually give the pronunciation in one of the fields, which is incredibly useful. Okay, now it might be for giving a nickname, but this is particularly useful for like Japanese and Chinese names, because it can be very hard to know what the pronunciation is without being told. Definitely for Japanese names, you sort of have to be told. For family names, you can guess, but for given names, you sort of be told, because there's too much variation and too much specialization. You also know what you've said before. And remember this thing I said, you speak, it displays things, you click on it. That's a way for them to find out what you're actually saying, and therefore they're constraining. So it's not such a big problem. Well, it's still a hard problem, but it's not as big as what people were talking about. Then let's talk about personality outside. We were talking about this a few minutes ago. how does the assistant interact with you? Okay. Does it call you sir or ma'am? Does it call you by your first name? Okay. Does it call you by your title? How does it interact? And you get to choose. And it, therefore, can make decisions about how formal it should be based on that. If I tell my phone that it's got to call me professor, okay, that would be really weird to have a phone that called me professor. But supposing it did do that, it would probably be more formal when it was actually talking to me. When I know it should really be calling me Dumbledore instead. What should the phone's character be, okay? And there's lots of choices here, okay? You can even allow the user to have a choice, and actually the user will be much happier if you give them the choice. In fact, what you should probably do, we do this in speech synthesis all the time, if we only have one voice, it's any good. We have one voice and then we give two poorer quality voices and ask people to choose, and they're always much happier with the better voice. If you only have one voice and it's the same voice, they're never happy. But if you give them a choice, they're going to be happier. This is what you do when you're selling cars to people. So, and also if you give people the chance to personalize it, they build a better relationship with it. Siri, okay, for example, has made some explicit choices. I've no idea what they did internally in the company, but I've seen people choose voices and persona before, so I can tell you some of the things. Most of this is published on what you do. Is one of the things that they want to do with a persona, it's a good thing to do, is to make it polite, but not your friend, so that it's someone who knows you well, but you still have to be quite explicit with them. And because of that, you articulate clearly when you're talking to them, which makes speech recognition easier. If Siri was going to be your best buddy and going to talk to you in slang, you're going to talk in slang back, and then it's not going to work because they're not going to be able to recognize it. They say that Siri was externally, not within the company. They say that Siri was female because that's what a personal assistant is actually thought to be, and therefore female is the best one to do that. I'm not utterly convinced about that. I think it was probably much more along the lines of they did tests with male and female voices and they liked the female voice better. There is fairly good evidence that males prefer female voices for assistants and females prefer males voices for an assistant. And realistically, imagine the team of people who made the decision and imagine what the male-female split was. Okay, there were probably more males than females when they were making the choice, because that's unfortunately the case in most. Please change that in the future. The other thing that's a little interesting is that the UK Siri, which came out about the same time as American Siri, is male. It's not female at all. And all the Brits think that Siri is a male name and not a female name. Okay, and so why is that? Well, it's pretty obvious. If you grew up in the UK like me, you're pretty used to having a male butler, okay? All of us had a male butler growing up. Isn't that right? No, I don't think that's the case. Also, I don't know what happened here, but I think they made some bunch of test voices and the male voices was found to be better. Actually, both the US and the UK one, you can choose the voice and change the gender, but most people don't do that. They don't even know you can do that. But it is interesting to note that Cortana, Google Home, Amazon Echo, all by default have a female voice. That might be because they don't want to stand out and be different from the other ones, but it's probably also they tested it with a bunch of people that might have had more males than females in it and ended up choosing with that. But it's probably overall the quality of the voice that's actually something that they're actually doing. Okay. But it is interesting that these choices there, and different cultures may actually want male or female different from doing that. What you also have to do is you have to choose what it's going to do, and you have to make sure it does these things well. As I said before, if it doesn't work the first time you use it, you're never going to use it again. So, what they did was they decided there's going to be a bunch of things that Siri does and it's going to do them very well. And they chose some number, let's say 12. In fact, I hear different numbers about that. But some relatively small, finite number, less than 20 apps that they're going to actually make work really well. And so they spend a lot of time on making it do, alarms, sending messages, doing choosing a restaurant, doing navigation. They worked really hard on those and sort of ignored all the other things for the short term, so they could get people into being able to do that. So they chose the things in each of those, the information they would need, and they wrote rules and they built systems that would try to extract them and do those things well. When it didn't work, they then fell back to the search engine, okay, their question answering system. Okay, so most of the time when it was doing well, it was actually doing something that was pretty good at doing. It used to be Google, it isn't Google anymore. I think it's their own search engine. They also put a bunch of hardware on the phone to try to make their life easier because they wanted to know whether the person was holding the phone here or holding the phone here when they were actually speaking, because they wanted to change that. There's multiple microphones on most smartphones nowadays that are doing both beam farming of finding out where the main voice is and noise cancellation by looking at the others. So they end up being pretty good. And most of these phones are pretty good even when there's a bunch of humans speech roundabout that's not targeted at the phone. There's also this thing called marketing, okay? Sorry to disappoint you, but Apple's quite good at marketing, or you probably know that already. Voice search had been in PDAs for years, but trying to get a lot of people to use it was really hard, and only very fringe people were actually using this. What Apple did was they got a bunch of famous celebrities, and they got them to appear in ads, and they got them to say silly things to the phone, so that everybody got into the idea of, oh yeah, there's this new thing called Siri, and when I get my iPhone, I should say these silly things to the phone. And what they were really doing was they knew nobody's ever going to read the manual. And so what they were doing is they were seeding all of these silly things to everybody so that when they got a phone, the first thing they did was the silly thing that they saw the famous people do in the TV ad. Okay? And it was very deliberate to make people not say anything to the phone, but to most likely say one of these famous silly things that people were saying. Nobody can even remember what all of these ads were to begin with, but that's what they were trying to do, okay? And it worked very well, because when you got the phone, you said the silly thing to the machine. That was already high in the language model, so it worked. And so you tried something new, which then didn't work. And then you tried something simpler, and then it began to work. But it was a way to get people to start using things. So remember this when you're developing your own app in your university and you're going to release it. The only way you're going to get people to use your app is to spend lots of money on TV advertising and have famous Bollywood stars appearing, talking to your system so you can do that. So remember to put that in your budget, okay? It worked, okay? The other thing that Apple could afford to do was they knew their users, okay? Users of iPhones are typically relatively young. They're typically relatively technology aware, okay? So they're a particular class of people that were willing to go to new technology things. So they aimed at that to try to get people to do that. To begin with, they did standard English, and much as it embarrassed me, standard English in this sense means American English rather than British English. Although British English truly is harder because there's way more dialects there. To begin with, they weren't doing non-native, although almost everybody in the ASR team at Apple is non-native. I don't think I can name any American in that team. We're not supposed to say it was Nuance that was the recognizer on Siri for the first few years. but what they really wanted to do was have a smaller group of people who were using it that was successful in order to be able to get data that would allow them to actually train the system to improve it. This bootstrap thing is critical, okay? So they made a lot of press. They made it very clear, but the thing that they had to do was actually find out how people talk to these systems in order to be able to improve them quickly. So they're pretty successful. They were the first one to come out with a dialogue system. They were not the first ones to come out with a dialogue system. They were the first ones to be very public about it, and then everybody started moving towards it already. Google was already doing this. You could already talk to Google at this point, but people were not aware of it. And rather interestingly, Google, until very recently, has not tried to make it a persona. Okay, they haven't really given it a name. Google Home is not really quite the same as Siri or Alexa or Cortana, an actual name of an entity. But Google's tried to keep it, you know, less personal than that, which is an interesting technique. You need an SDK. It's all very well to try and control the interface for everything that's in your control. Ultimately, you want it to be for everything. Google's been much more open about their ASR and TTS than Apple. Apple have not allowed you to do this. They allowed you to do it on the desktop for a long time, but not on the device. But that's changing. Microsoft, even though they've developed Cortana, they've released Project Oxford that some of you are probably aware of, that's really pretty good as a way to get developers to actually use this technology and build it into their own apps. And that's ultimately the thing you want to do. If speech is going to survive, you'd like to be able to have everybody use it. Almost nothing in these systems cares about the previous utterance. Almost no long-term dialogue is going on in these systems. They may be asking you some bits of information and they may be confirming it afterwards. If you do an alarm, they'll want to know what time it is, maybe what name it is, and to cancel it. But there's almost no dialogue in these systems. And that's something that, you know, is a little missing. So yeah, they call themselves dialogue systems, but they're all pretty limited. At this point, I actually want to ask you all, hands up if you've spoken to your phone. ever. Keep your hand up if you spoke to your phone this week sometime. Okay? So, thank you. This is something that is quite interesting, and all of the companies see this, is when you first get it, you use it, because it's cool, it's different, okay? And then it, like, falls off after that, and then people don't use it so much. So of those of you that used your spoke to your phone this week, what did you speak to your phone about? What did you use it for? Reminders.
Search.
You're testing the TDS. See, that doesn't count. reminders seem to be the most common thing that people actually use speech for. It's a little frightening how important reminders actually are, but I suppose reminders are important to us. When I think about what I use when I do it, I do reminders. If I'm searching for a place, I'll often say it, especially if it's a full address, because that's much easier than typing it in, and I think I can say it better than I can type it in. So I might be tending towards that. What you should be aware is that young people actually are happier talking to machines. Now, all of you are sitting there, or most of you are sitting there going, wait, I'm a young person. No, you're not, okay? I'm teasing you a little bit there. But by young people, I mean teens and lower. As far as they're concerned, there's always been speech. It's just always been there, okay? Because it's been there for more than 5 years. And they talk to machines all the time. I find it a little frightening seeing my friends' kids who just talk to the machine all the time, and they just expect it to work, and it does. And so as they grow up, they're going to do that more. Yes.
But he uses the phone efficiently just by speaking to it and downloads all kinds of games that he wants.
And so, companies do care about their future. So what they want is people of the future to use it. And these people who are currently under 15, 10 years from now, they're the ones who are going to be buying things. And they're the ones who are just going to be talking to their machine all the time. And that's interesting, okay? And that makes us old, yes. But, you know, that's the way it goes, that you're going to have to address that. There is this is related to this. It's like, will people talk to machines, okay? Will they actually do it in public? Now, I'm old enough to remember when cell phones started coming out and it was considered weird to talk to your cell phone in public. And I remember being ridiculously self-conscious the first time I got a cell phone and I had to speak on the cell phone in public. It seemed really weird to do that and thought everybody was looking at me until I noticed that everybody else was talking on their cell phone and I was late to it, and so it's not. But talking in your phone is now completely reasonable, and it's not considered weird anymore to see somebody walking down the street or on the bus talking to themselves, okay? They're not. You just assume they're talking on the phone, probably, okay? But talking to a machine is still something that's a little weird, okay? We haven't quite got to that, and you can tell when you hear somebody talking to a machine. They talk in a different way, and it becomes obvious. But gradually, that's going to become more and more. And gradually, that is something that everybody is going to do. Maybe some of you have seen the XKCD joke that everybody in the US is now doing, that when you go to somebody's house, what you should do is say, Alexa, the name of the Amazon Echo machine, Alexa, order 50 gallons of milk. Yes. Okay, and then people are then going to discover that they probably should lock up their device a little bit because they'll get 50 gallons of milk delivered to them the following day from Amazon. There is this long-term use that will get better and more people will do it. Younger people get used to it and then they actually think that's reasonable. And as they grow up, they're probably going to continue doing that. So this then brings us to the final part of the talk, where I actually really want to talk about data-driven techniques. All of the things I've talked up to so far, although there is lots of statistical machine learning going on in these systems, fundamentally, they're handcrafted. Fundamentally, their initial structure is done by a human who decides what structure is going to be there. And that's a good thing to do. Doing completely unsupervised learning is probably going to not work for dialogue systems. In fact, it's almost the case that this is a challenge that's next to impossible, Okay? Now, of course, the machine learning people are never going to believe you, and they shouldn't, because I always want the machine learning people to give me better machine learning techniques because it's really useful for me. But if you want to solve the problem, you're probably going to have specify a little bit more structure that you're then going to actually do some form of machine learning on it. Many people who work in purely data-driven techniques think the dialogue is something to do with question answering. And it sort of is, but it's not completely to do with question answering. The point is about dialogue is it's interaction with two people, and you can fix things, you can ground things, you can ask clarification questions, you can confirm that things are working. If you're confused, you can go into more detail. If you know that the person understands things, you don't need to go in as much detail. You adapt to the other person that you're actually talking with. And that's very important in human dialogue. And machines can't do that, okay? And machines learning from data would be very hard to do that, because the amount of examples that you need now no longer is just question-answer pairs. You have to have all dialogues with all possible forms of detail, all possible forms of expert to novice that you're doing. And you're just never going to find that amount of data on there. I know you think that Google has all the data on the planet, and they do, but that's just not enough. Dialogues are almost always unique. They've never happened before, and so it's very hard to find examples of the things that are happening there. So dialogue and question answering are not the same thing, okay? And it's very important to realize that. And when you look at these personal digital assistants, they're much closer to actually the question answer thing and less like dialogue. They don't have long-term rapport. They're not interested in building up a relationship over time. They really are quite localized question response things that are actually going on there. And that's something that we would like to solve. And this is why data-driven dialogue systems is an interesting research area, and it's a worthwhile thing to move in, because it's what we're eventually going to do, yet the data is always going to be limited, and we're going to have to find ways to be able to use that in the most efficient way to be able to get new systems that can actually do that. Most people refer to this paper as one of the first conversational data-driven techniques. But actually, it's not. There was a special session at SIGDIAL in 2012 that was on data-driven dialogue systems, and there was a number of papers before that. Most of them were not using neural nets to do it, so therefore they don't count. That's a little unfair. This is a very interesting technique, and it is surprisingly successful. They're basically fundamentally using sequence-to-sequence models and really using the techniques that were used for machine translation. So they're basically looking at sort of utterance and response. They're often called question answering, but it might not be a question and an answer, so we'll just call them utterance and response. And what they're trying to do is try to find out, given the utterance and all the possible contexts out of data that utterance could appear in, can you generate what the response should actually be? This is sort of like translation in the sense that you have maybe in one language you want to translate it to another, and you say, well, I want to find out what the appropriate response is, and maybe it's sort of similar, and there's definitely some parts of it are similar, but there's interesting notions of truth here about getting the actual answer or the relevant answer is still something that's particularly hard. But Auriel Vignoles and Coquelin at Google did this. One of the things that they did in this was they took the internal forum for troubleshooting for computing at Google and built a model from that and tried to build conversational agents that would actually allow them to converse about answering questions for troubleshooting. Okay, so here's a cherry-picked dialogue system that they actually generated. This is pretty good. Okay, so machine says hi, human says hello. Machine says, could you please let me know what are the operating systems you are using? It's a somewhat weird question when the problem hasn't even been stated. Human says, I'm using Linux. Machine says, okay, it was in the SSL VPN on which you stay. This clearly means that VPN is almost always the problem when you're trying to solve problems, which it probably is. Of which you stated it was broken. This is relevant words, but a bit of word soup there. It's not really clear what it's asking. Then it says, please check if you're logged into the CARP network. That's a pretty good thing to do. Are you actually successfully logged in? That's very relevant. Human says, I'm seeing an error related to VBM. Machine says, what is the error message that you're getting when connecting to VBM using Network Connect? And again, a little bit messy, but it's a relevant question. It's important. It's something that's going to help debug it. And so they build systems like this that sort of work. And this is interesting, okay? That, yeah, it doesn't quite do the conversation. It doesn't actually do task completion of solving a problem to let you actually connect to the corporation network. But it is actually doing something that is beginning to have cohesion behind it. But it's still some distance from it. So how could you improve this to try to make it better? The evaluation criteria for these things are incredibly hard. Most of the time that they try to do something like Perplexity, so it's like a language model, or maybe BlueScore to be able to look at held up data. But these things are so indirect, it's sort of very hard to know whether things are improving or not. But a number of people are now doing this, and it's now actually including a number of my students are doing this in non-trivial ways. Chi-Wei Li at Stanford is one of the PhD students who's been doing this for some time, and he's been working with a group in Redmond, Microsoft Redmond, the Tay group. And what they were noticing was that when you're building these systems, is they can give quite good responses, but they don't care what they said in the previous response. So you could have a conversation like, where do you live? System response is, I live in Los Angeles. Whether that's true or not, that doesn't really matter, but that's a good response. And then if you ask the question, which city do you live in now? It says, I live in Madrid. Okay, maybe there's a Madrid in Los Angeles somewhere that I don't know about. Okay, and then they say, in which country do you live now? It's like, wait, what, England? Okay, they live in multiple places. This is not cohesive with a normal conversation, and you would think that the person that you were talking to was, you know, not sensible if you were actually doing that. Likewise, you know, where were you born? I was born in Canada. Where are you from? England. I suppose that's possible. You're born in Canada, moved to the UK. Where did you grow up? Texas. But you know, that's not how a human who was born in Canada, now lives in England and was brought up in Texas. That's not how they would say. They would, you know, do some things like, but I grew up in Texas, or now I'm living in, and they would do explicit things. And this is things that don't actually get captured properly. And this brings in this thing that these systems are relatively good, but they're really not cohesive. They're really not putting everything together. And so we already talked about Xiaobin, Xiaoice, that was developed by Microsoft Research in China. And so I have a little video of that.
从今天起，我们看东方节目会迎来一位特殊的见习主播，我们先请他亮个相。嘿嘿。<laughs>
很高兴能在今天这个特别的日子开始我的新工作，因为今天是冬至日。Okay,
so I'm going to have to translate, not because I know Chinese, but I know what it is. So let's actually put it back, because I know you don't speak Chinese, but you're going to get a little bit more of Chinese when he first introduces her. Xiaobin is a teenager, okay? And she's not a teenager because that's what they're modeling. It's because when they built the system, they realized it was not very coherent and kept changing the subject. And so they decided post hoc that it was going to be a teenager so they could blame the teenager for doing things. Little did they know that the teenager is going to grow up and take over the world, but that's a different problem. So this is a news reporter, and this is carefully edited to be quite good. But you'll hear that when she first speaks, she says, hee-hee, she laughs at the beginning. She's got a cutesy voice, that's deliberate, so that they have that persona coming through. Remember I said with Siri, they've got this adult female professional voice to try to give you that feeling, okay?
很高兴能在今天这个特别的日子开始我的新工作，因为今天是冬至日呀。
So she's talking about where she comes from and what she's interested in, okay? But all very superficial, okay? Almost no detail of information.
Okay.
So he just asked for the weather in Shanghai.
好的，谢谢主持人。今天冬至了，俗话说冬至前后冻坏石头。 不过有好吃的汤圆，再冷也不怕了。
So she not only gives the weather, but she talks about local festivals that's actually happening in Shanghai and talks about how the Shanghai food is, because that's important. Okay? So she finds ways of being able to add additional information to try to engage the person in the conversation. What is deeply frightening about Shaolice, or maybe not deeply frightening, what it shows about the future is if you look at the logs of how much time people use talking to Shaolice, the answer is a lot. People spend 30 turns on average. So there's a group of people that would consider to be repeat users, and they will typically interact 30 turns. Think about that. Think how many people that you exchange 30 turns in short messages in a day, okay, on your phone, and people are talking to her 30 times, multiple times a week, okay, and there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people doing it. They don't give that number, but I believe it's in the hundreds of thousands, so it's actually quite a lot. So this works. I don't know if it's useful. I mean, I know the people in China, when they developed it, it was sort of a fun research project to do. I don't think they really expected it to take off. But people are willing to talk to this system, and they get something out of it, which is actually pretty interesting. Okay?
Question.
Yep.
Earlier it said that it just talks about nothing but here, it's answering some relevant questions.
Yeah. So they do have embedded in it particular things it can answer, so things like about movie times and weather, and so they can do that as well. Okay, so it's not that it won't ever talk about anything in particular, but you can talk about, and you can talk about it, relationships. One of the examples I've used in our things is about, so you tell her that you've just broken up with your girlfriend, boyfriend, and you don't know what to do, and she'll give you advice, not necessarily good advice, but she'll give you advice. Okay, and so you talk about things like this, but you can also talk about things like weather. You can talk about specific things. So they've got rules in there that try to identify. So it's not all automatically learned from data. There's a bunch of rules in there that they're trying to do it as well. They haven't told me that, but I'm pretty sure that's the case.
Yes.
Don't they have lives, these people? Don't they have, like, homes to go to and important things to do? No, sorry, I'm not going to make judgment about these things. Remember, entertainment is really important, okay? Entertainment is a good thing, okay? And if it's the case that the only thing you're allowed to do is, you know, has to be for educational reasons, then your life would be pretty boring. This, people do it, so that's okay. But it's interesting. I haven't heard the same uptake for... It's not called Tay, what's it called? Zo. I haven't held the whole update for that. Do they have an SDK for that? Can you actually build your own system into Zo? I know they were talking about going to do that. We had a talk from them recently, and they talked about the possibility of doing that, but I haven't heard anything further than that. You know, people are using these things. I was recently at Amazon talking about, I probably even have a, there's my Shaolice thing. I'm going to talk about the Alexa Prize. So Alexa Prize is a competition by Amazon where they selected 12 universities, might be more than that, 15 universities to build chatbots for their Amazon Alexa system. You get the prize of $1 million if you can have a conversation for longer than 20 minutes by a bunch of judges who are going to be pretty strict. I don't think anybody's going to win that. I don't think that's possible. Mostly US and Europe. Actually, there's a bunch of Canadian universities. They're not in the US, but North America and Europe, where the Echo is actually released. In fact, it's actually in continental Europe, and the Echo has not been released there. It's going to be an annual competition, so it's going to happen again. And the idea here is, we're going to have conversations that are natural, but all of the people building these systems, I'm leading one of the groups at CMU, we have two groups at CMU actually, are usually got these neural systems, and they've got targeted systems about particular things, and they've got, you know, raw question answering stuff, and trying to choose between them to try to get a coherent dialogue, which we don't always do. choosing between the different systems of task and non-task is sort of interesting, and finding the best way to be able to do that. while I was at the recent summit, I asked the head of the Amazon group for Alexa why they thought chatbots were a good idea. I mean, I think they are interesting from a research point of view, but why does a company that cares an awful lot about making money, that's what Amazon's really, really focused on, why do they care about doing casual chat to these systems? And they said, well, it's like this. People are already talking to the system in a casual way. So what they find when they look at their logs of the data that's actually coming in, people are not saying, Alexa, what's the capital of France? They're actually saying, Alexa, I had a really shitty day today and I'm really fed up, so why don't you play me some nice music? Okay? It's not what you should say to a system. You should say, play this piece of music. But people are being casual to the system already, even though the system's incapable of actually responding. I'm pretty sure Cortana is actually in the same space. I do remember Jason Williams telling me that one of the most interesting things about Cortana data was looking through to see what Cortana doesn't do and see what people are actually saying. And you get to understand how people perceive these things. They don't understand how it works, and they are starting to make it, you know, say things, and then developers look to see what it is and try to improve it. And so from this point of view, what Amazon sees is people are being casual with the system, and they'd like to be able to respond better when they're actually doing it, which is an interesting point. although, and now our systems, as of last month, anybody with an Amazon Echo, and there are at least hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions of systems being deployed, anybody who has one can just see Let's Chat. They'll get randomly connected to one of the 12 systems. They can have a conversation and they can evaluate it afterwards. We get weekly reports on how well we're actually doing this. About once every 2 weeks we get cut off because we said something we shouldn't, some abusive thing. We're all trained from this data, and every so often some data gets through that's either racist or adult content or something about Donald Trump. Apparently everybody wants to talk about Donald Trump, and we were warned, don't ever say anything about Donald Trump, because apparently he's not funny and amusing and something that you can talk about. And so we try to filter this stuff out, but it's incredibly hard to filter out the data. So this is actually one of the things about the group here working on trying to detect whether things are clear or not, or, you know, looking at abuse. It's hard to actually know whether somebody's actually saying something. And yeah, you can filter out swear words, but that's nowhere near enough. But what Amazon is actually really doing, which I actually think is really good, okay, and it's not just about the competition, it's not just getting a bunch of free PhD students work on their dialogue systems, but they are getting that. Actually, at CMU, it's a bunch of master's students, so we're cheating with them. but it is. They're making it a field, they're making it a research field, and that group of people are going to continue to publish in that area, do their PhDs in that area. But they're not just exploiting us. I don't think they're doing that at all. What they're also doing is they're giving access to the researchers, the user base. And that's probably one of the most important things. One of the hardest things in dialogue systems is, how do you get access to the users? It's really, really hard. You build a dialogue system and you try to get people to use it. Remember earlier on this morning, I talked about what happens when you do control tests. These people do things, they're not the same as the real users, and therefore you really want real users, okay? And so if you build a chatbot and the only people who actually use it are a bunch of undergrads in a class that you told them to do it, otherwise they wouldn't get credit, okay? They're not normal users, okay? They're going to break the system in interesting ways, but they're not the type of people. And so what Amazon's actually doing, which is really interesting, is saying to the developers, the researchers in universities, here, get access to our user base, okay? And please don't say anything racist or anything about Trump or anything about Hillary. But trying to do that, and so you can actually get access to these people. Now, it's not all just altruism from Amazon. Amazon doesn't want to be caught with a chatbot which becomes racist, and they get a bunch of bad press because there might be other companies that got stuck in that position. Although I find it rather interesting that Ruhi Sarayara, who used to work at Microsoft Research at the same time, is now at Amazon doing the same thing. But anyway, so he must know about that. They're not just doing that. Here, what they have is a bunch of universities building systems, so if anything goes wrong, they can say, well, universities, it's not us that did it. Okay, so it's a way to pass the blame as well. But this is fine. I mean, this is quite a good thing, and people are probably slightly more forgiving for universities than they are for the companies. But we are very grateful that we get access to the users, because that's actually quite important. The other thing that's happening is we're getting data. Okay, there really isn't much data out there. I was hoping that we'd be able to get this data released afterwards, but now that I actually look at the data that's coming in, I'm not sure we are. It's full of privacy stuff. So our bot says something like, hi, I'm a bot created for the Alexa Prize competition, ask me anything. And people say, so where were you born? And we have a background story and we actually do things. And then the people say, I'm Alan W. Black. They don't say that, they say their own name. You know, I was born in Edinburgh and I grew up in Scotland and lived in England for a while and lived around the planet. And there's all this detail about them. I mean, actual real information. Well, I assume it's real information, but lots of people are giving pretty personal information that's in there. They're not giving us their bank account number yet, but, you know, it's because Amazon already has their bank account number. But people are giving very private information, so it's going to have to be filtered. From that point of view, maybe people here, if you've seen Cortana data, it's the same thing. People are very open. They don't seem to care about the privacy issues of that. Back to the data-driven stuff, just a little thing about data sets. People are trying to find good data sets to be able to train from, but it's really hard to find them. The ones that they standardly use have all got significant problems on them. So there's open subtitles, which is subtitles for most movies on the planet. It's never very clear what the legal position of these things actually are, but they've been there for a long time and nobody's shut them down. So, and there's a bunch of standardized data sets that people are using. The problem with the open subtitles is that you don't know when a speaker change happens. It's just subtitles. So there's no information about who is actually saying it, whether you've changed from one person to the next. So that's not ideal. You could try to do some filter thing about that, because there are like 80 million subtitles or something in it. There's a lot. There's another database of TV closed captions, so there's TV subtitles, but they actually usually do identify who's speaking, so you can actually get utterance boundaries out of them, so it's slightly better. But it's not clear that TV dialogue is the same as other dialogue. It's written by a human, it's written to get a story over, it's written to be funny or emotional in some way, so it might not be the best thing. So people are going, well, let's look at forums online. So like Shao Ice, at least initially, was using Microsoft developer forums to be able to do things, although I find it interesting that Microsoft developer forums in China are like 16-year-old girls, but maybe I don't know about the developers in China. But Ubuntu forums is one of the major sets that are actually used, so discussing about how to fix problems under Ubuntu. What you quickly discover in those forums is words like apt-get are very important, because they are, okay? But what you also discover is when you're trying to generate things from it, it will generate apt-get install and then random package name that's not a package name that actually solves the problem that you just asked about, because it doesn't care about truth, it cares about surface-level information. Reddit and other type forums are actually quite good, but it's surprisingly hard to find consistent conversations in these forums, because people don't have A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B conversations. They're much more random than that, so it's quite hard to be able to find long-term conversations. Likewise with Twitter and Weibo, the Chinese Twitter. Twitter isn't used for conversation. I mean, it is, and a small percentage of it is about conversation between two people going back and forward. You might get people who are actually diagnosing problems across Twitter, but it's quite hard to find. The data is quite hard to search for. It's not as easy. At CMU, we get access to something that we call the firehose, where we get 10% of all Twitter, but it's a random 10%. So it means that if you've got a conversation that's got four turns, you might not find all the conversations because you've only got 10% of the data. It's random. They're not linked. So you've only got a 10% chance that you have the second utterance, and then you've only got a 10% of a 10% chance you've got the third utterance, or a 10%. And so it's actually surprising that there is ridiculously large amounts of data there, but it's quite hard to find lots of data, and you've usually got to target to particular subparts of that. None of these are perfect. We are trying to actually try to build better data sets where we're forcing people in Amazon Turk to talk about a particular document. So we do have 10 to 20 turns that are about the same thing, but we don't really know how to constrain the speakers to stay on domain. And also, the Amazon Turk people, they're not talking about it for the sake of it, they're talking because you're paying them money. And therefore, it's not natural in some sense, and so you have to care about that. So the machine learning people say, let's just take all the data and we'll train. And then when you say, we don't have any data, you say, well, you have to go and get some data. You say, no, you don't understand. There isn't data. And in fact, we can probably even prove that there cannot be data, because as dialogue is much broader than anything else, you have a choice at every single dialogue state, you're actually going to spread out more and more and more. And you're never going to find data to cover all of that. So we are going to have to come up with machine learning techniques that take data like this, that allow us to be able to separate things out and to be able to reuse things. And so this is probably sucking out the content from the style, at least, and be able to factorize and actually deal with those in a different way, probably, okay, if there's problem. And there might even be multiple ways of factorizing it to try to get the best information out of it. And that's something that we're beginning to look at, and other people are beginning to look at, but it's still going to be some time before we actually have solutions to that. Talked about that. I'm going to skip that. Realistically, there really is these two things that are happening here. There's the task-oriented bus information thing that we're pretty good at. It succeeds. It does very well. But it's pretty unnatural. Okay? We've learned a lot from these systems about how people interact from a very localized point of view, how to maybe deal with grounding, how to deal with error correction. But they're very, very targeted. They're not nice to use. There's not something you're really going to do. It's to get the information, and that's all. At the other extreme end, we have the non-task oriented, where you really are talking about nothing, where you chat. It's sort of fun, okay, but it's not directed. And that's actually probably not what we want to do. Yeah, there's the entertainment thing, but we'd also like to be able to do some sort of combination of this. We want something that interacts with you, that you feel happy about, that you like, that you learn to trust, that you build rapport with, and so it becomes your personal assistant. It knows what you like, it knows what you dislike, it knows how to describe things to you, and it knows how to get things done for you, so you actually get benefit, explicit benefit, when you are doing task-oriented things. And that's ultimately what we need to do. And we're really some distance away from doing that at the moment. Okay, so there's still a lot more to do. It's great that we have deployment into people's homes and on their phones, but we still have a long way, so it really becomes the robot that appears in science fiction movies that is there as companion, assistant, that's actually going to help you out when it should be able to help you out. So this is this recent thing that we started looking at, and here we've been looking at it, IIT Madras group, have been looking at how can you take a particular document or a particular domain and say, we're going to talk about this. We can say anything, we can give opinions, we can give facts, we can talk about it in a general way. We're not going to pre-program the states that we're going to go through or the content that we're actually going to talk about. And so we can change the content to something else and still talk about it. So that can be a Wikipedia entry, so it could teach you about something. It could be about a movie, it could be about a place, it could be about linear algebra. It could be a frequently asked questions, it could be a product, okay? So there's lots of different things it could actually be for education, for selling, for just giving background information. All of these are possible. It's an open dialogue, but it's targeted at a particular thing, and we're trying to collect data in that space to be able to do that, so that we can actually see if we can build systems to do this. evaluation is even harder here, okay? We don't really know what a good dialogue is. We don't know how to measure it. We don't know what success is. So there's no task we can measure success with. we think this is an interesting thing to do, but we're still not there on finding a way to evaluate it. That in itself is going to be a research thing. It's probably something to do with engagement. Can you judge engagement? Actually, externally, humans are quite good at going, yep, that's engagement. That people are definitely into it at this point, or that person is not in. They're fairly consistent, so if you ask multiple people to look at something as a third party, they do relatively well in it. You know, did the bot stay on topic? Did the human stay on topic? Did they play with it? Did they deliberately try to mislead the system? Or maybe ultimately you want to find out whether the user learned the information or got the information. That, you know, do they now know more about the movie? Do they like it? Do they dislike it? Do they have an opinion on it? Is it an informed opinion? And maybe you want to do something like that. We don't know. And we're going to have to do a bunch of experiments and find out which of these are reliable. And maybe different metrics are going to be important depending on the task, the ultimate task that you're doing. Okay. We have set up a challenge for this in NIPS this year where we're going to talk about things. We're going to have competitions between people and bots. So if you look up Conversational Intelligence Challenge, you'll actually find and you can register for that. And we'll be releasing more data in bots later on this year. But all of these systems are relatively naive when it comes to actually how humans interact. Okay, so although I've talked about all of these machine-based systems that get through a conversation, that's not how humans do it. Okay, I mentioned some of these things before, but back-channeling is pretty critical in human conversation. And we do it all the time. We go, mm-hmm, aha, acha, at the appropriate part. And if you don't do it, it sort of breaks down the conversation. You don't have to do it all the time. Actually, there's some experiments that show that back-channeling happens between people who don't know each other more than it happens between people who do know each other. Because when you know the other person, you know they're listening. Or alternatively, they're a family member and they never listen, so it doesn't matter. often these words are things that are not explicit words that are in the lexicon, so they're hard for speech recognition. They're usually ignored in speech recognition. Prosodic delivery becomes really important, and timing becomes really important, because you actually get people giving these back channels before the other person's finished the phrase. And for a machine to be able to do that, I've seen some Japanese systems which actually do back channels, and the best way they show their effectiveness is when they deliberately break. And this is what they do, is they make it so that the system does the back channel at the least appropriate point rather than the most appropriate point. And you can't hold a conversation with this thing, because as soon as you start speaking, it breaks in and goes, hi. And it's like, that's just the wrong place to say anything. You're not in a conversation with me. It's broken, okay? Getting it to do it in the right place is much harder, but they're actually relatively good at it now in some of these Japanese robots that will do the right thing in these conversations. And that's something we're going to have to do, okay? Let's get that. Timing, as I say, is critical, and actually most of our systems are nowhere near fast enough to do this. They're nowhere near fast enough, okay? So you've got to sort of get recognition before you get the audio. You've got to be able to do anticipation of the prosody of the other person to know what's going to happen 500 milliseconds from here to know when to say aha, because it's going to take, you know, at least 50 milliseconds to start generating the aha, and another 50 milliseconds to fill the audio buffer so that you start speaking it at the right time. Surprisingly hard, okay? Yet humans are really good at this, and they do this prediction in the future about when to actually do this to make it natural, okay? Don't underestimate gesture and gaze. We often talk about speech here or text, but actually face-to-face communication is something that humans are really good at. And we know that when we can misunderstand when we only have the voice, and we can misunderstand when we only have text. And so it's pretty important if we can have eye and hand gesture, and what's happening of where the eyes are going. It's not that they're looking at you all the time, it's that sometimes they do, and if they never look at you, then that's weird. Smiles make a difference. Head nods all make a difference on how you actually communicate. And if you don't do it, you're losing something in communication. And so it's something that we're going to have to do. And there are lots of people beginning to work on these points. there are also this register shift thing that happens when you're talking to a machine as opposed to when you're talking to a machine. So frame the machine, you actually change the way that you speak. But this is also true that if you're talking to somebody at a help desk directly and then you turn to your friend, you sort of change the way you speak. And Dan Bohus has been doing some of that, of trying to recognize. We saw some of the videos yesterday where basically if two people are standing in front of the machine, work out when they're talking to each other and when they're talking to the machine. Humans are really good at that, and this is something that we're going to have to do too. And laughter, okay? If you look at any multi-party communication, it's full of laughter. Some ridiculous amount of utterances have actually got laughter in it. It's important. It's part of human communication. And it's not just we're telling jokes all the time. It's something to do with how we interact. It's both nervousness, politeness, being part of the team. You want to make sure that when your robot is in the a participant in the meeting, it laughs at the right time. Okay, when the boss makes a joke, everybody should laugh, including the robot. Okay, and so we need to do both laughter detection and laughter generation. Okay, and that's still something that's a little bit far away. People have worked on it. Some of Sri Narayanan's students have done laughter generation, and it's beginning to get away. But laughter itself is quite hard to generate. There are multiple different ways of laughter. You can have laughter in speech itself, and you can have laughter that's separate from speech. It's got to sound the same. It's got to be appropriate for the communication. You know, when the hearty laughter is very different from giggles or smiles that actually happen, it's something that we're really going to have to deal with, and it's still somewhat far away to do that. This participant in the meeting that Monojit yesterday mentioned, which is one of my grand challenges, I want to build a robot that can sit in our meetings and take part genuinely in the meetings. It should be able to speak without being, if I ask it to speak, it should be able to speak, but it should know when to speak when it wants to speak without threatening the other members of holding up its laser weapon so that everybody else shuts up. It should be able to know when it can actually speak. It should have something relevant to say. When it does have something relevant to say, it should say it, okay? It should laugh at the jokes that are going on. It should know when to groan at the jokes that are going on. It should understand. And we're so far away from that. And that's something that I'd like to do. If it's going to be your personal assistant, it should be able to do that. It should know when it can interrupt. It should know when it actually can give information. And it can know when it's supposed to shut up and not say anything at all. And so that's still something that's some distance away. So our conclusions for this are, actually, human-machine communication is pretty practical nowadays. We can communicate with speech, okay, and text with machines and get information out of it. That's already there. But it's still not a very natural way, and there's extra things that happen in human-human communication that could benefit in human-machine communication and get more efficient communication. It gets the answers faster. So you don't have to do the grounding, you don't have to do the back channel, you don't have to do the explicit confirmation. It builds rapport, so people know how to be able to do that communication, and therefore they can do it faster and with more confidence that it's actually successful. Okay? It's not just to pass information. So if you think about your colleagues, your friends, your family, you don't just talk with them to be able to get information. You actually talk with them to build long-term rapport and to be able to communicate more easily, more. Know when they're happy, know when they're sad, and be able to see differences in their style. humans are already treating machines as conversation participants. That's not going to go away. They're already joking. They're already being nice. They're already insulting their machine. And so the machine should do that back. Well, maybe not the insulting back, but it should be able to do the communication. So the machine has still got an awful lot to learn. And finally, I want to show one more thing. Not that I think that the whole world is going to get taken over by bots that will end up being our colleagues in the future, but I do want to point out that some bots, artificial beings, are already having some success in our world. In Japan, which admittedly is a different planet from here, from everywhere, there were a bunch of people who worked on singing synthesis at Yamaha, and they used technology from Barcelona, and they built a system that would allow you to be able to write songs that get sung by an artificial voice. Then a bunch of other people took that and they built an anime character which was projected in 3D and would actually sing songs, okay? It's J-pop, so whether you like it or not, it is a particular genre, okay? And so Hatsune Miku was born, who's an artificial character who sings songs, has concerts, actually gets high in the charts. People pay money for her music. So I'm going to play a little concert, recording at a concert of her, okay? You listened to the Chinese one and I had to do translations for her. I'm not going to do translations of her Japanese. I don't think it's necessary. You'll get what it's all about. Paid to go to the concert. So just to give a few more comments about that. So it's a 3D projection thing, so depending where you are, you get to see round it. So it seems like a real character that's there. And just as you're all sitting there going, you know, only in Japan. This was filmed in Los Angeles, so this was a concert in the United States. So while you're thinking that it's only going to happen in Japan, you have to say it's only going to happen in Japan and California, which are quite similar. But this might be the future where we have artificial bots, and then the question is, does she have a personality? Can you go and talk to her? Can you actually interact with her? And do her fans care about it? And you know, do they end up with a personal assistant that's a particular form? So that's it for today. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes. Yes.
You mentioned about the bot learning from the children.
Sorry, say again.
You mentioned that one technique of demonstration was about whether it could learn from the interaction.
So the idea is that most of these systems have got some background data that they're actually learned from. And so well, it'd be nice if you could actually have these systems dynamically learn from the conversation. So if you said something like, if the system asked you what age you were and you gave your your age, it should be able to remember that and you should be able to use that in the future. But these systems absolutely can't do that in any way whatsoever. So it'd be nice if the systems could actually learn from it. But likewise, the human who's actually using it, could they actually learn the information that the system's talking about? So if it's going to talk about a movie, you could then ask the human at the end, did you learn anything about the movie that you didn't know before? And did you retain that information? So if you were going to use one of these systems to actually teach you something, so you imagine that you have an article that's teaching you history about a battle or history about a particular person or some math concept, you could actually quiz them at the end and see whether they've actually learned it. And that might be a way to evaluate the quality of how well it interacted with you. Which I think would be a good way to, it'd be hard to do, but that would be a valuable way of showing success.
In the first slide, you mentioned something about the three main classes of learning. One was task-based,
yes.
One was interactive-based, yeah. Another one was classification.
Yes.
Could you just elaborate a bit on the classification?
So the classification is, it's really almost a one-off thing. So supposing your system can do 20 different things. Supposing it basically you have 20 human experts and your job is to direct a call to a particular expert and the person describes what the problem is. Can you identify which expert it should actually go to? And that's the classification problem, the how may I help you, where you ask an open question, you get a bunch of random words back, and you have to decide which of a finite class of systems, possibly and other, okay, to be able to answer it. And that's a very common form for some of the early spoken dialogue systems that they're actually doing.
Is it possible to use deep RL systems to come up with a policy for back channeling, like when should it interrupt and when should it not interrupt? Can we use deep RL systems to do that?
So yes, you can do that. In fact, systems are now quite good offline for telling you sort of where you can do back channel, but live systems are particularly hard because you need to almost go back in time. There's some prediction things that humans are very good at. They know, because even humans have about 300 milliseconds from when they decide to make a noise than when it actually happens. And so that's something that's just, you know, hard to do, because you're saying that sort of before you should know to say it. And we'd like the system to be able to do that too. So we have to be faster or predictive or something. But if you do it offline, it's a little easier.
So in a similar manner, like the slide just shown yesterday, where it shows a robot like actually interacting with two people, like seeing their faces and all.
Yes.
So like, could we incorporate vision or like these imagery to enhance this dialogue?
So there are a number of people, including Dan Bohus, working on visual additional information. And we also have this, you almost showed the Sarah system at CMU from Justin Cassell, which is a persona that's trying to build rapport, and it includes facial recognition and gesture recognition for the participant to be able to know when the person's nodding, whether they're looking at the system or looking elsewhere or smiling. And that is an important additional piece of information. And humans use that all the time when they're actually in conversation. So yes.
So that like reduce the effect of these back channeling, the timings and all.
Well, it's another piece of information to actually help, but you've still got timing issues, even with that information. And you've got to process it, and you've got to process it in almost negative time, which is surprisingly hard to do. Buffering in all of these systems becomes a serious problem, even though you think computers are fast enough. But you know, doing things in sub-100 milliseconds is really hard on computers. But yes, people are doing that. Yes?
I remember something back, I think Simon Sinek gave a talk on how we evaluate the system. One of the things which you mentioned was ask people to write what they're using. I thought the evaluation.
Yeah.
Going the same lines, one of the things, I mean, when you say the person has learned something from a dialogue, it doesn't make sense to ask, like, did you, like, what, not exactly what you learned, because it's again becomes harder for the analogy.
Yeah.
Probably some specific questions, like, setting me in this direction, it doesn't make sense to.
So I think it really does. I mean, I always believe that task-oriented, in-app oriented evaluation is a much better goal than trying to find these abstract things, because you can super optimize for them and they're not right. So if you could get somebody and it was a conversation about X, you'd want to find out whether the user got any information about X, so it would be a reasonable thing to do. One of the things that we do in text-to-speech, though, when we ask people to write down what they hear, is because most synthesizers are pretty good, you've got to make the task much harder. So we use these semantically unpredictable sentences. So you get all these nonsense sentences out of them that are very hard to remember the words, so that you get a big error, so it's easier to judge. And I'm not sure how you can do that in dialogue systems, but maybe you can do that. But I'd love to see a little bit more, did you learn anything from the dialogue, asking the user afterwards. So yeah.
These small things that you keep on mentioning, like did you ask something from the user perspective, or like making the bot ask this, is this another way of like engaging the user as a result?
Yeah. I mean, it could be. I mean, so you can make the bot itself, you know, if the purpose of the bot is to chat to you and teach you something, so it'd be a reasonable thing about the bot saying, did you get that? What did I tell you about? And so it would be a good way of engaging and finding out whether somebody actually understood something. So yes.
Right now, the current scenario is that most of these bots, they're aimed at specifying or like solving a specific task. Right. The way we ask it to solve the task, that may be said in a bit casual manner or more like in a rule-based format, as we already said.
So most of them are rule-based for particular tasks. They're the ones that work. And at the other end, you have these open conversations which don't really go anywhere-ish, you know. But, you know, we saw in the Chinese chatbot, you could still ask about the weather and it could deal with it.
Objective is that we want to get something out of this chatbot or experience. Like, it should solve a specific task or a bunch of tasks, but it should be that the interaction with the bot need not be in the manner in which we like type something or like give it in a rule-based format. We want the conversation to proceed in a natural manner as we do with humans, but we want the action that to be delivered to be very specific in nature, right?
So yes, but I think it's quite hard to define what that really means for different types of conversation. Being able to teach you something, being able to build a rapport over time that makes it easier to teach things, is going to be hard to evaluate, except over long term. And that's just going to be hard. You have to release a whole bunch of bots and see which ones are still your friends after a year, you know?
So you mentioned about a lot of data sets and none of them are quite good. And most of them, or rather all of them, were essentially text.
Yes.
Now, we might have a lot of speech recording, let's say interviews and
other things.
And suppose they don't have transcripts. Is there a way to use that data?
Oh yeah, there are ways to do that. And we've also looked at, so one of my students, Joe Yu, was looking at various audio recordings of dialogues. She worked at the Educational Testing Service that does TOEFL and other things in the US. And they have a lot of data that they do interviews for testing people's English capability. And so they have a lot of data like that. And so so there is data like that. You can use ASR to a certain amount to get approximate transcripts, and you can usually select the ones that are nearer correct than others. So there is more data to be able to do that. And that would be better data too. But public data in that space is hard. We've tried to mine YouTube because it's effectively public. It's not, if you identify which YouTube videos everybody has access to them, you can't redistribute. You probably don't want to redistribute because it's too big. And tried to find things where there are two people talking or arguing or debating. And there are a number of groups which have things in there, and they're quite good. We'd like them so that they could see each other and so that we have a camera that actually looks directly at them, so we can start to look at facial stuff. And there are a few like that that we've begun to look at, but that might be the place to actually find more data. Yeah. Okay.
Great for that.
2:30.
In that room.